8th. I had to check that day. I sort of lose track of time. Please turn off your PDAs, electronic devices, cell phones, et cetera, et cetera. We have a policy that you'll contribute to the Common School Fund if I hear it. It interrupts the testimony of our folks in here. Yes?
Madam Chair, you have...
That includes you.
I understand. And you have very articulately expressed that admonition every morning.
I do.
My simple question is, how much do we contribute to the Common School Fund?
It's up to the discretion of the chair.
As are many things.
And as we move along in session, it gets a little steeper.
Yes, we get testier.
Yeah. And if you're here to testify today, please sign up on the side. We have several things going today, so we're going to get started. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 434, and while Ms. Richardson talks to us about what the bill does, I'll ask Senator Gordley and the representative from Senator Deckert's office to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 434 directs the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to establish a multicultural student-to-teacher loan program. It forgives loans, which would forgive loans for service in an eligible school district and provide higher forgiveness rates for service as a guidance counselor, mathematics, science, or second language teacher. It provides guidelines for loan application, award, repayment, and deferral. It establishes the Multicultural Student-to-Teacher Loan Fund in the general fund and appropriates money to the fund. Would you like me to speak to the Dash 1 Amendment as well?
Yes, please.
The Dash 1 Amendment renames the program as Multicultural Student to Educator Loan Program and the fund as the Multicultural Student to Educator Loan Fund. It defines eligible participants. It requires service or employment in an Oregon school district. It defines commencement of the period for the employment requirement, and it increases the amount of the forgivable loan and overall amount appropriated to the fund. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, great. That, colleagues, that does mean we won't be sending it to the floor. We'll send it to Ways and Means if we think it worthy of doing so. I think we'll probably find that out here in a moment. There, we have several guests today signed up to testify. No one is opposed. We have 35 minutes set aside for this today, and I think we can get it done. So, Ms. Pollack and Senator Gordley, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Avelle Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County. I am going to be very brief because we have phenomenal expert witnesses prepared to provide testimony on Senate Bill 434. I do want to say for the record that this is a monumental opportunity for our state to advance education, to advance public education. With regard to race relations in our nation and in our state, we are in the second grade. We are in the second grade. We have failed to plan as a nation and as a state for our future, which is today. We have failed to plan for the classrooms of today, classrooms that are full of children from different races, ethnicities, cultural backgrounds. We have failed to prepare, but this is one of the tools that we need in our toolbox to catch up, to where we need to be, so that we are, in fact, building the capacity to provide a quality non-racist education to every child, attending a public educational institution. And so with that statement, Madam Chair, I am going to return to my seat unless you have questions for me. I'm just so excited about the quality of testimony that you're going to be hearing. I thank Dr. Algie Gatewood from Portland Community College. I thank Dr. Peter Cookson from Lewis and Clark College. And I thank the phenomenal Deborah Cochran, who runs the Portland teacher program. Again, exceptional testimony you'll be hearing. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill. And I also thank my colleague, Senator Deckert, for taking a leadership role in bringing this public policy issue forward. We had the pleasure of sitting together with Dr. Cookson, it may have been 2 years ago now, to talk about this concept, which is really a concept that comes from Dr. Cookson. And to finally be here at this moment, being able to bring you a public policy for your consideration is just a wonderful day. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Pollitt?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I, too, will be brief. I just want to read.
What's your name for
my name is Sasha Pollack. I'm representing Senator Ryan Deckert's office and his district in Washington and Multnomah County, Senate District 14. Senator Deckert was very sorry not to be able to be here today. He is very excited about being able to present this bill. He finds it very important. He is concerned by the disparity in the diversity of the population of teachers throughout the state of Oregon when compared to the growing diversity of the student body. I just want to read very quickly a paragraph from something from the Education Resources Information Center Digest. It was written several years ago, but I think it's even more appropriate today. The multicultural classroom creates a demand for teachers who are aware of the cultural differences within the student population, differences that affect learning styles, behavior, mannerisms, and relationships with the school and home. These students need the support of teachers from their cultures who have an understanding of cultural and family practices and behaviors and who can serve as role models for educational achievement and success. I think this is one of the main reasons that Senator Deckert is excited about this bill, and I, too, thank our expert testimonies who are here today, and I will leave the floor to them unless you have any questions for our office.
Okay, thank you, Senator Cruz.
And maybe, thank you, Madam Chair, maybe this is not the right panel, but explain to me the difference. What is a forgivable loan?
A forgivable loan is a loan which, should the loanee do one of a variety of things that are outlined in the bill, teach in an Oregon school district, and specifically teach in science, special education, second language, and math, a portion of that loan will be forgiven by the state for that period, one quarter of it for each year teaching in the school system. We're also worried about students who become educators continuing their lives as educators here. So the retention is an issue as well.
Okay, I believe we have other programs that do similar things, so loan programs, like for nursing and different things like that. So
yes.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. I'm going to call up the Portland contingent, all three of you, Dr. Gatewood, Dr. Cookson, and Dr. Cochran. And if you just choose who wants to go first and state your name for the record, that would be great. If you have testimony you'd like to hand out or any exhibits, make sure you give them to our committee assistant, Ms. Gravel.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators, members of the committee. My name is Algie Gatewood. I am the Cascade Campus President, Portland Community College. First, I want to acknowledge my appreciation for the opportunity to present to you this morning. I want to thank Senator Gordley and Senator Decker for their invitation to be here this morning as well. And what I want to do is to share with you just a little bit about my experience with regards to scholarship loan programs, forgivable loan programs. Cite a particular program in the state of North Carolina where I worked for several years. Talk about some thoughts that I have with regards to the to Senate Bill 434 and make some suggestions as to how I believe this bill could be improved. First, I worked with the North Carolina State Education Assistance Authority, an administrative unit of the University of North Carolina, for 7 years immediately prior to coming to Oregon. In total, I have 33 years experience, 26 years experience in community colleges, and of course the 7 years experience with the university system. Throughout all of that experience, you know, I thoroughly enjoy what I'm doing now, but I also enjoyed working with the scholarship loan programs. one of the great points about those programs is that they are used to attract people who either are or will become seriously interested in pursuing careers wherein there are shortages. These loans are also excellent for attracting people of color, which we are so desperately in need of in education. Although I was over a total portfolio of $58 million with forgivable loans ranging from medicine to dentistry to optometry to teaching and school administration, of all of those career areas, I think the state of North Carolina made the best investment in the teaching scholarship loan programs. I administered or co-administered two primary scholarship loan programs. One was the Prospective Teachers Program, and in that program alone, the state makes between 200 and 250 awards a year. I also administered the Teaching Fellows Program, which is a sizable program. It started in 1987 and has been extremely successful. From 1987 to June of 2006, the program actually reviewed 37,486 applications. I think that number in itself indicates how it really is attracting people who want to get into the education, teaching side of education. During the time of the loans, the program made 8,197 awards. 5,350 of those have already graduated. Some are in school, some have retired, and some chose other fields. Because of this program, of the 100 counties in that state, 98 counties are being affected positively by at least one of those graduates. And at any given time today, this one program provides over 3,000 teachers in that state in any given year. The Teaching Fellows graduates employed in the fifth year after the four-year service payback equates to 81%. So after 5 years, 81% of those individuals are still teaching. Between the fifth and 15th year, 67% are still teaching. That means that some have retired, some have gone on to other careers, but 67% are still teaching. Between 2004 and 2005, 76% of those graduated actually became employed. And the Teaching Fellows graduation rate is 84%, and I understand that it continues to rise. Now, the financial incentive is the key. And that program provides $6,500 a year for students to pursue these careers. And it attracts a large complement of minorities and even males. I think 20% of the Teaching Fellows students thus far have been males. Now I'd like to talk about my thoughts regarding the Multicultural to Teacher Loan Program, Senate Bill 434. First, I think it's a wonderful way to get more people of color in particular and others into the teaching profession. I think that this program in other states, similar programs in other states, have proven that they can be very successful. I believe that this program that you are proposing should perhaps provide an even greater monetary incentive to students. When I first wrote this, the figures was at one point, but now I understand it's up to $5,000 a year, which would be a greater way to capture the interest of students and to get them hooked on education. You may want to consider the repayment obligation described in Senate Bill 434, where recipients have one-fourth of their principal amount forgiven for each year of service following graduation. Through my experience, I've found that the simple formula of 1 year of service for 1 year of the loan seems to work very well. So that's a suggestion to you. You propose 5% interest when students have to repay in cash when they do not go on to teach. And although that is very modest and it sounds very fair, I believe that a 10% interest rate would ensure greater retention in the teaching profession. It would also ensure that students are retained while they're in college and go on to teach. 10% may sound like it's a real penalty, but my experience has been that this is what probably helps to bind this program in a very successful way. Hmm. It's also suggested that in order to supply well-qualified teachers in low-performing or on-warning status schools, you may want to consider having accelerated repayment options available. So in other words, if you have schools where we have a serious need of particular kinds of teachers, then rather than 1 year service for 1 year of work, we may accelerate that to make it even more attractive for those well-qualified graduates to work in particular areas. I would also suggest that you target prospective teachers in high school. My experience has also been that many students would pursue teaching, but they can't get in college, let alone through the sophomore year. Moreover, if we target students while in high school, there is an opportunity to have more parental and guardian involvement, which undergirds the success of any student in any educational track. I would suggest further that rather than providing deferments for students to pursue education in any area, in other words, once a student finishes the program with these funds, he or she goes on to teach, or if they go back to school, it seems to me that it would make sense that they should be in some profession that's going to support education and not something that is totally different from education. It's suggested that the loan program include a cohort experience that begins at high school or wherever the starting point of the loan may be. We have learned that the cohort experience really helps to keep people engaged, and it helps them to learn more about education and the importance of the scholarship, and it builds social connections, which leads to economic paybacks. In closing, I truly believe that Senate Bill 434 is a Cadillac. It is not a Volkswagen. I think it's a Cadillac form of bringing more people into the educational system, particularly people of color and underrepresented groups. And you know as well as I do that there is a high demand for these people because we have severe shortages across the state of Oregon and across this nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gatewood. This is exactly why we love to have public testimony. You have given us some really great ideas to make this bill even better, and I appreciate that you've come down today. And I know Senator Cruz has a question he's dying to ask, and then we'll get to the rest of the panel.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate it, and I do think you've offered some suggestions that I find probably very positive, but based on your experience in North Carolina, could you speak to the fact, and this is one of the things that troubled me, is that it restricts these students to careers in counseling, mathematics, science, or second language. I'm wondering if it should be broader than that, or how did North Carolina handle that?
North Carolina restricts it to teaching, and okay. And it does include counseling.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I'm just wondering what the thought behind that was, because
if they're allowed to go into other career areas, then we missed a target.
Well, yeah, and I understand that, but it's. This is teaching, but only certain disciplines in teaching, as I read it. It says guidance counselor or as mathematics, science, or second language teachers, unless I'm...
Yes, I understand your questions, Senator, and in North Carolina, it is broader than that. They can teach reading, literature, history, a range of courses.
Okay.
And Ms. Richardson has some comment about this.
If I might, Senator Cruz, there's a higher forgiveness rate for employment in math, science, second language, or special education that would be one-third of the accrued interest for each academic year, but in any other teaching field, that's one-fourth of the principal amount. that's forgiven. So it's not as though there's no forgiveness for other types of teaching and employment.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand that, but as he said, you know, I think reading is as important. And I'm just wondering if we need to take a look at that as we're moving forward with this bill.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay. And I'll hear from one of the other two.
Mm-hmm. Well, good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of this committee, for inviting me and my colleagues to come this morning to discuss and to advocate for Bill 434. My name is Peter Cookson. I'm the Dean of the Graduate School of Education and Counseling at Lewis and Clark College. And I want to thank Senators Gordley and Deckard for promoting this bill and sponsoring it. I'm going to just sort of, I've given some written testimony, and so I'm going to sort of run through that and leave time for questions. If, in my estimation, if we were to close the achievement gap in Oregon and we were to choose one thing that would really make a difference, I would say diversifying our education, our educators, our teachers, our counselors, and our administrators would be a huge, huge step forward. And I'm going to outline to you why I think that is the case and make my argument. First off, we know recently from an Oregonian article of, I think it was February 6th or so, that that our student population is becoming increasingly diverse. Particularly in the area of Latino-Latina students, there was a huge rise, not only in the metropolitan areas, but throughout the state. While the white population is declining slightly, the Latina population is growing dramatically, as well as the African-American population, Native American population as well. So our schools are really different than they were 10 or 15 years ago in terms of the students that are attending them. And it's not just that they come from different backgrounds. Many of these students come from different countries. Many speak English as a second language. Many have are refugees from terrible situations. Many of our students, or a good number of our students, are technically homeless. So the population of the schools, the public schools in Oregon, are dramatically different and we need to think out of the box a little bit about how we're going to help these young people attain the skills they need to survive in Oregon and throughout their life. Now, that diversity has led to another startling fact about education in Oregon, which is there is a genuine achievement gap between the minority and majority students. If we look just in one data point, I cite several data points in my written testimony, but I'll just cite one for example. The national tests of student achievement in Oregon in 2005 discovered that 55% of African American students in the fourth grade reading level were below basic standards and proficiencies. 63% of Latino-Latina students were before below basic proficiency standards. Now, what does this number mean in terms of reality of the youngsters that are going through schools? It means that by the fourth grade, if you don't have the basic proficiency to be able to read at a competent level, your chances of success is in terms of, if you think of critical junctures in a person's life, are really, really diminished. And it leads to all sorts of other issues that are related to that. It leads to, eventually, to a very high dropout rate. We have a very high dropout rate in Oregon in general, but particularly among minority students. It leads to boredom in the classroom. It leads to lack of engagement. And so we see reflected in these numbers the fact that we have this achievement gap. Now, one way to think about the achievement, there are multiple ways, but one way in which this bill addresses directly is who's teaching these youngsters and who's counseling them and who's leading these schools. One of the statistics that this bill, I think, really directly addresses is that in terms of teachers, counselors, administrators, and educators generally, there is a lack of representation among African-American communities, Latino-Latina communities, Native American communities, and others. For instance, in Portland, again, I have more data in my written testimony, but I'll just touch on one thing. 13% of the students in Portland are Latino-Latina. 3% of the teachers are from that background. 16% of the students are African-American. Less than 5% of the teachers are African-American. I know at Lewis and Clark we have been really making a huge effort to diversify our student body in terms of relatively young people who want to be teachers and principals and counselors. And what stops most of them from being able to participate in our program and other colleges and universities is the lack of funding and their inability to pay for what is relatively a high price. And therefore, they're excluded from entry into these professions. So this idea of creating a pipeline through forgivable loans is would make a huge difference in how many of folks from African American backgrounds, from Latina backgrounds, from Native American backgrounds got into the educational profession. The other part of my testimony, which I'd like to touch on for a minute, is you might say, well, that's fine, but what evidence is there that if we diversify the educator population, it will have an impact in closing the achievement gap for our students? Well, there is actually quite a bit of information. It isn't just a sentimental kind of feeling. We know from the literature that students need mentors and role models that they can identify with. That is a key in a young person's life. And while background isn't the only characteristic, it certainly is important. And why is that? Because we also know from research that multi-contextual teaching, contextualizing learning and teaching in a student's background, being able to understand the cultural milieu from which the students come, to be able to use that background to make teaching and learning relevant, to be supportive of ways of learning, to understand that, does make a real difference in kids' lives. It's not an abstract thing. It's a very specific thing that happens in the classroom. And therefore, by diversifying the population, you're going to make the curriculum more relevant, you're going to have more engagement, the students will be on task, and eventually that will result in higher test scores for the students across the boards. So I want to leave time for questions. I would just like to touch on one thing that President Gatewood touched upon. I think raising the amount of money that is in the bill to support these students is a tremendous idea. I also believe that it should be broad-based and include, as the bill does, all folks who want to be educators. There may be some slight differentiation in going to key areas, but we should support all the folks who want to go into education. And in sum, I would say that if I were to pick, having visited lots of schools here in Oregon and other places, if I were to pick one thing that would make a difference in a child's life in terms of his or her opportunities for success, it would be the teacher, the counselor, and the principal that they interact with every day. We're talking, you know, people this tall, more or less. And their opportunities are shaped by the adults that they interact with, and the warmth and understanding and the push for success is what's going to make a difference in these kids' lives. So I think this bill is a tremendous step forward in improving education in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor. I think we'll hear from our other guest first before I open it up for questions.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Cochran, and I'm the director of the Portland Teachers Program. And I want to thank Madam Chair and the senators for this opportunity. And I particularly want to thank Senator Gordley and Senator Deckard for this bill. It's a very important one, and I stand in strong support of it. For people who are not familiar with the Portland Teachers Program, it is a partnership effort among Portland Community College, Portland State University, the University of Portland, Portland Public Schools, and Beaverton School District. It is designed to increase the number of culturally competent teachers with a special focus on the recruitment and retention of historically underrepresented groups in the teaching profession. Our program provides tuition and support services for students from their freshman year in college all the way through a fifth-year teacher education program. During our 18-year tenure, we have graduated over 100 teachers from African American, Native American, Latino, and Asian American backgrounds. But this is a drop in the bucket when you realize that 94% of the teachers in the state of Oregon are white. And you've already heard the figures from Dr. Cookson about the changing demographics of the classroom. I have spent these past 18 years watching brilliant and dedicated students of color who want to give back to their communities as they starved their way through college to become teachers. Even with our tuition waiver and whatever federal financial aid they could qualify for, the majority of students in my program must work one, two, and sometimes three part-time jobs to make ends meet. And as they struggle to become licensed teachers, they sacrifice time with their families to keep their grades up and their bills paid. But all too often, they also sacrifice study time to work more hours to pay those bills and thus are often not able to meet their full academic potential or earn the kind of grades that would make them competitive for additional scholarships. These kinds of sacrifices impact their ability to gain all the knowledge they need to be the best teachers they can be and want to be. And given that many of my students arrive at the doors of our college academically underprepared from their own K-12 education, which, by the way, they are victims of exactly what Peter has been talking about. They have been victims of institutionalized racism and low expectations. And because of that, they must work twice as hard as at their college coursework as their more privileged counterparts. Financial problems are the number one reason that students drop out of my program. When you have to make a choice between paying the rent and feeding your children or going to your math class, you drop out of school so you can take on that extra job. Or you drop out because emotionally and physically you simply can't juggle it all anymore. Or you drop out because your grades fall below the requirement to keep your scholarship in our program. And not because you weren't smart enough, but because you had to work when you needed to be studying. What makes all this especially amazing to me is that these committed and visionary students do all of this to go into a profession that will certainly not make them wealthy, where they will work long hours, where they will often be blamed for the failures of decisions they had no role in making, and where they will receive very little public appreciation, recognition, or celebration. My program turns away dozens of students each year because they cannot afford school, even with our tuition waiver. They can't afford to give up health insurance that comes with their jobs, or they have house payments, or they may be supporting other family members. Please fund this bill, and please use it to encourage historically underrepresented groups to go into teaching. The need for teachers of color is critical as the demographics of our classrooms grow more culturally diverse every day. An African-American mother told me a story the other day that underlines the need for more teachers of color. Her young daughter came home from school one day last year and said that she wanted to paint herself white. When her mother asked her why, she said that all the teachers in her school were white and that they were important people. She wanted to be like them. She wanted to have their success. She wanted to lead a classroom and empower others someday. But she thought you had to be white to do so. This mother then sent her child to a school with more diverse teachers where children were thriving. Unfortunately, the school was closed due to budget cuts. By the way, that mother of three is in my program. She is working two jobs while she attends school full time to become a special education teacher, and I worry about whether or not she'll be able to hold up all that energy for the next 4 years. Children of color need to see people who look like they do in front of their classrooms, and all children need to learn from and come to love teachers from diverse cultural and ethnic backgrounds. We know that K-12 classrooms are one of the most important battlegrounds on which we can fight racism and oppression and build a democracy that is truly inclusive. If we look at the number of men of color in prisons versus the men of color in colleges, and if we look at how desperately we need men in the teaching profession, and if we look at what we spend on building and maintaining prisons, supporting this bill should be easy. When we look at the billions of dollars our society spends on sports and athletes, supporting this bill should be easy. If we can support wars, prisons, and million-dollar basketball contracts, surely we can invest in helping people join the most important profession in the world, the profession that helps us maintain democracy by educating citizens to think for themselves and to engage in their communities. Surely we can invest in helping Oregon grow its own teachers, especially teachers of color. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cochran. I'm going to open it up for questions. Let's try to keep it a little bit brief. We have some more guests. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is not with respect to the merits of the bill. It's the merits, I think, are excellent. My question addresses, is there a potential of building a false sense of expectation for students that would enter into an educational program and then, in fact, not have the opportunity for employment within this state once they graduate?
Well, do you want to tackle that?
Well, the retirements, and Peter may want to talk more about this, but the students coming out of my program are not having any problems finding work, whether they're elementary, middle school, high school. Clearly, if they, you know, go into the high need areas like math and special ed, they're swooped up more quickly. But everybody that has come out of my program is getting a job, and it is because of the wave of retirements. And this is true nationally as well as in Oregon. And I don't know, the two of you may want to add to that.
Well, I think, Senator Morris, the demand for educators in Oregon is actually quite intense. And because there are so few teachers, counselors, and principals of color, particularly in the areas that are identified in the bill, but other areas as well, that I'm pretty confident that they will all find employment extremely rapidly. In our program at Lewis and Clark, everybody who graduates finds a job in teaching in Oregon. So I feel pretty confident that would be the case.
I think those are really good, clear answers, because I would have said the same thing. And all of you touched on the population changes in Oregon. In last session, we had a presentation in this committee from the Housing and Community Services Division, who had done a study on housing in Oregon, and it was a population study, and it was mirrored what you were talking about today, how our population has dramatically changed and we've not kept pace, you're right, in the teaching profession with the diversity. And I know it's been a strong pet project of Senator Gordley's for the last couple of sessions to try and bring that cultural diversity into our teaching profession. And I don't think anyone here disagrees that we need to do that. And this program really sounds like a neat one. So thank you for coming today. I'd like to hear from the other three folks who are here. And I'm going to ask you, Dr. Gatewood, to work with the drafters of the bill on your suggestions, because I think they're really valuable. And I'd just like you to have that conversation with them, and maybe we'll bring it back for further amendments, because I don't want to overlook those suggestions you made.
Very good. I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'll call up our final three guests today, Vicki Merkel, Rachel Cummings, and Lorena Landeros. Yeah. I've been practicing that, Lorena. And we're running just a teeny bit behind time. If you have testimony, if you could summarize it, because we can read it, but if you want to summarize it, that would be great. Would you like to go first?
Yeah, mine's pretty quick. So, good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lorena Landeros. I'm a student at the University of Oregon. I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition, as well as myself, to urge you to support Senate Bill 334. OSAC is an affiliate board of the Oregon Student Association, which represents over 100,000 students in the state of Oregon. When I was a first grader, in addition to learning how to read, I first had to learn how to speak English. Language was a huge barrier to my success, and I clearly remember my teachers in the first and second grade that worked with me and taught me English. Those years were some of the most formative formative years of my life, and I dream of someday doing the same for students in Oregon. I want to be the person that they can rely on and have confidence that I'm there to help them succeed and overcome their language barrier. I'm a first-generation student with 2 years left in college, and I'm already $18,000 in debt. I assume I will graduate with over $30,000 in debt after my undergraduate and graduate years, which will be hard to manage with a teacher's starting salary. But I am committed to becoming a teacher. I want to make sure that students growing up have role models that look like them. I look back at some of my teachers who were critical in my formative years, and none of them looked like me. I don't think that they understood my culture, my family, or me. I want to be a role model for students like me who have different culture and language. And with Oregon's changing demographics, we need to ensure that there are teachers that are able to teach the students in their classrooms. Senate Bill 434 is critical to ensuring that Oregon meets the demands of our changing demographics. While I feel committed to becoming a teacher, I am worried that my debt will make it hard for me to be financially stable as a beginning teacher. This bill is a step in the direction of making sure that low-income, first-generation, and students of color will be able to become educators in our K-12 system. I may be able to beat the odds and become a teacher in spite of my debt, but we need to find ways to encourage an education workforce that looks like the students they are working with, and Senate Bill 434 is a key piece to that. I urge you to vote to pass Senate Bill 434 and the -1 amendments. It is important that not only teachers but also the entire education workforce is representative of the student body, that I am an example of why increasing the forgivable debt to $15,000 is a good idea. Don't worry, I would still have plenty to pay back even after I teach for 4 years if this program existed today. Thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think I'd like to hear from the other two, and then I'll come back because I've got a question for you.
Okay. Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Merkel. I am the Scholarship and Access Programs Director at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission in Eugene, and I'm sharing this testimony with Rachel Cummings, who is our accounting technician for public programs. I oversee a private scholarship program that brings nearly $14 million to Oregon students and access programs such as the Aspire Mentoring Program in high schools. I also oversee loan forgiveness and loan repayment programs. We understand that this bill to establish a multicultural student-to-teacher loan program encourages students who will enhance the cultural diversity of Oregon public schools as teachers to borrow for their education. I'm going to skip most of my testimony that supports this intent and just want to say that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission fully supports this bill to encourage students as described in the bill criteria. The majority of financial aid offered to students on campuses statewide continues to be loans. However, research shows that families without a college-going culture are reluctant to borrow money to pay for education. These students may work and attend school part-time to avoid taking out loans, as was mentioned before. From the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Ms. Cummings and I would like to provide you with technical feedback from our experience with two previous federal forgivable loan programs assigned to our agency. I'm sorry, I said federal. They were not. One was federal, one was state. The Oregon Teacher Corps program 1987 to 1993 awarded students in a similar forgiveness program, and we are still in 2007 collecting on some of those loan debts. The Oregon Nursing Loan Program, which was awarded from 1991 to 2003, was also a loan forgiveness program. And we want to offer you several other options for your consideration. Lacking federal funds, these programs stand apart from other loan programs, especially since they are not eligible for loan consolidation. We have seen that this is a source of confusion for students. The restrictive eligibility for loan forgiveness may be contributed to the high percentage of students who did not fill their loan obligation. Because of this, the state of Oregon changed the Oregon Nursing Loan Forgiveness Program to a loan repayment program in 2001. And I'd like now to have Ms. Cummings explain a little of the technicalities.
Okay, that's great, because Senator Cruz had mentioned we had other loan programs in existence, and it's nice to be refreshed about how that works and how this can fit into that.
Okay.
Thank you. If you state your name for the record, please.
I'm Rachel Cummings, and I'm the accounting technician at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And thank you, Madam Walker and the members of the committee, for hearing us. I've been asked to testify because I'm the one that works with the students that have participated in these loan forgiveness programs. And I started in 1989 and have grown old with a lot of them. These programs have gone on for a long time. I don't have the exact figures, but at one time when we were changing the Oregon nursing program to the loan repayment program, it was like 30% of the people didn't fulfill their loan obligation. And this was for a number of different reasons. And an example is one student I know is, well, she's a nurse, but she got cancer, is not well, can't work, but can't be, she doesn't have a permanent, can't be labeled permanently and totally disabled. So her loan goes on. And others, many others, have moved from the state following their spouses. Some started families, which put back the time that they had to fulfill their obligation, and then it was too late. They had to repay it. And then there were several teachers that just didn't find it a good fit once they got in the classroom. I mean, went through the whole program, and then they just couldn't manage the classroom. And for us, there's been no administrative fees for these programs allocated by the state of Oregon, and there isn't any for this either, even though it is very cost-effective, especially when it goes into collecting these loans, because we have to, you know, pay careful attention to collection laws, which can produce libelous situations if it's not done correctly, especially with bankruptcies, and which we've had plenty of also. And so that's, of course, an issue for our agency. In the past, we've been able to rely upon our guaranteed student loan program, which was a part of our agency. But in 2003, that was reassigned by the U.S. Department of Education to another entity. So we no longer have the expertise of that division to kind of help us with these, you know, collection issues.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could just finish the testimony from OSAC. I do want to reiterate, even though I didn't spend time, that we fully support the intent of this program to bring multicultural students into the teaching profession to stay in Oregon and be role models for current multicultural high school students. But we do want to offer two other funding delivery options for your consideration. The first that we're very familiar and have expertise in is awarding gift aid, funds that are not a loan with no repayment required. We have experience in administering nearly $14 million in private awards, where rules are written to help the donor, which in this case, of course, would be the legislature, to locate the students who would most likely fulfill the intent of their program. We would do that by helping the donor. We do that by helping the donor prioritize the type of students that they want to serve, the point of entry into the program, et cetera. The second option, and that's the one we've referred to before, is a loan repayment program. And it actually took me a couple of years to figure out that difference between loan forgiveness and loan repayment. Loan forgiveness is described as that the state is the lender. In a loan repayment program, like rural health services and nursing services, students could be awarded a certificate while they are in college to participate, but they would borrow money from a traditional lender. And then upon completion of their service, we would reimburse their loan in a similar manner that's described in the bill already. We do this for rural health and nursing services. So a practitioner who serves in a rural area for 1 year, we then issue a check that they can use to pay their own lender with. Students would borrow, again, from a traditional lender, which takes the state out of the loan business. I would also suggest that the interest incurred from a traditional lender be accounted for in the award. And again, I want to emphasize that while we have concerns about the long-term viability of loan forgiveness programs in general and the costs associated with administering them. Frankly, a student can enter into this program at age 20, and we may be involved with them till their early 40s if they're not able to fulfill their obligation. This purpose of this bill and this program aligns with the mission of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, especially in creating access to higher education for underrepresented students, and we do support the bill. Thank you for your opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. It's clear, I think, that Senator Gordley, we need to have a little work group. If you could, you and Senator Deckert's office could put that together. You've offered some important points. Everyone here has, and I think they can be resolved in a work group to try to work through those. I especially appreciated the testimony about the nursing program and the problems some people have had in completing it. Dr. Gatewood's suggestion that we increase the interest rate to 10% if you fail to complete the program, I thought was a clever idea. But then what do you do about the woman in your program who has cancer and can't repay? And, you know, I've been a court reporter in bankruptcy court for 23 years now. It's really, really hard for students to discharge their debts in bankruptcy court. You practically have to be dying because the government is going to get you. So I'd like you to have some conversations about that, how it is that you're not going to be getting an administrative fees and maybe some of these alternative ways of funding it. But if you could do that and come back, we'd be happy to put it on, yeah. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm especially interested in the rolling private potential in here, which would increase the amount available. But I would also request, Senator Gordy, that you consider in your accelerated part of the forgiveness program to include, for example, reading and special ed. I think those would be good ads.
Okay. And Ms. Landeros, I applaud you for wanting to be a teacher. It's not a six-figure income job. My son is coming back to school and getting his master's degree. He, too, wants to be a teacher. He's decided he's played around being a ski bum long enough and that he's been teaching people to ski, and he realizes, yes, I like teaching. So he's a male, which is great. We don't have enough of them. But thank you for wanting to do that, and thank you for testifying today, all of you. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 434, and thank everyone for coming today. Okay, we're going to head real quickly into, I know that Ms. Smith is here. She has to leave the building at 10, so I'm going to go ahead and take Senate Bill 215. We'll open a public hearing on that. And we may end up going to 384 if we get too long into that. But Ms. Richardson, you want to talk to us about 215?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 215 allows school districts to admit students up to the age of 21. It defines a person in a parental relationship for determining school district residency. It permits students whose residence is determined by public or private agencies to stay in a school district attended prior to placement until the end of that school year. It rescinds provisions governing residency of children with disability. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007. There are -1 amendments. Would you like me to speak to them?
Yes, please.
The -1 amendment retains the provision that permits students whose residence is determined by public or private agencies to stay in school, to stay in the school district intended prior to placement through the end of the highest grade level offered rather than through the end of that school year.
Great. We have two people to speak today, one for and one against. Mr. Harnish from the Department of Ed, it's the Department of Ed's bill, so why don't you come on up?
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Randy Harnish, and I'm with the Department of Education. This bill is kind of a composite of four different sections, all dealing with residency and enrollment issues. One of those is dealt. We have had conversations with the Juvenile Rights Project folks and Department of Human Services, and we put out the -1 amendments and agreed to leave the existing language as is.
Good.
And so Section 1, we don't need to deal with at this time, unless you have particular questions about that.
No, I just found my note with the Juvenile Rights Project,
great.
And we had had a conversation, and I had hoped you would make that change in the Senate, so thank you.
The second section on lines 12 through 17 defines a term that is in statute that really is quite an important phrase, and that's person and parental relationship. School districts' residency, student residency in school districts is determined by the residence of their parent, legal guardian, or person in parental relationship. We have a legal definition of parent and legal guardian. We have the phrase person in parental relationship, and it is not adequately defined in statute in this section. We do have similar definition in other sections of the law regarding defining parent-child relationships, and actually we came up with, or we borrowed the language from that statute to define person and parental relationship. We believe that the law is very clear on the residence of students from the continuum of biological parent, legal guardian. Person and parental relationship is a little gray, and then if you get to the other end of the spectrum, the federal McKinney-Vento Act for homeless students is also very clear that students who are homeless are deemed to be resident of the district where they live. That definition of person and parental relationship, we believe, really needs clarification. Districts are all over the board as far as how they interpret that. We believe that the definition that we're putting forward here really recognizes a more realistic view of the living arrangements of many of the kids in the state face, either by individual or family decisions or for financial or for personal reasons. And the definition basically says that a person in parental relationship is an adult who has physical custody. That's as opposed to legal custody, but physical custody of a child. They live in the same household, and the person interacts with the child daily, provides the child with food, clothing, shelter, and incidentals. It specifically is not created by a power of attorney or other written delegation unless there are the other evidence of parental relationship is there.
I'm sure.
Senator Cruz has a question before you move on.
Well, an example would be student is, let's say, entering his last year of high school. The father gets a job in another town. The parents move, and the student moves in with a family of a friend. This is what that would address.
Senator Walker and Senator Cruz, yes.
Okay.
If that's another example that we hear regularly is the situation of a student who, for whatever reason, is having trouble at home, needs to go live with aunt and uncle in Burns. The Burns School District has looked at, and I'm not using Burns for anything other than as an example, mm-hmm. is, I think, legitimately hesitant to enroll that student because the family that the student is living with is neither the biological parent nor the legal guardian, nor is that student necessarily considered homeless. Mm-hmm. And so we get a lot of questions from the Burns districts of the state, trying to clarify that and get an answer to that. We believe that this would say, in those circumstances where a student is actually living with an adult who is acting as parent, that the district shouldn't be hesitant in enrolling that student and getting them in school and getting the educational process going. And we believe that this would speed that process along.
Okay. Does that answer your question? All right. Further testimony?
The second section on the second page, lines 31 through 33, deals with a kind of an inconsistency in the current statute that says, in the first paragraph says that districts are required to enroll students between the ages of 5 and 19. The section that we're trying to address goes on to say that if a student is over 19 but not yet 21 and receiving special education services, that the district must enroll them. The second section goes on to say if the student is not receiving special education services, has not received a diploma and is not yet 21 and needs additional education in order to receive a diploma, the district must enroll them. Well, I think in practice that is not necessarily the way all districts are interpreting that. Again, this forms the basis of many phone calls that we get at the Department of Education, and we would like to and offer a proposed amendment, a distinction between those two options for kids who are over 19 and not yet 21 that we believe makes more sense given the 5 through 19 compulsory age range. And that would be to say If a kid is over 19 but not yet 21 and receiving special education services, that the district must enroll them. If the student is not receiving special education services, is over 19 and not yet 21, and needs additional service or additional education in order to receive a diploma, that the district have the option to enroll that student, but not be mandated to enroll that student. I believe that's more closely reflects what the current practice is, and it more we believe it more appropriately fits into the model with the compulsory education language at the beginning of the section that ranges or that requires enrollment from 5 through 19.
So, Mr. Harnish, this is an amendment that we don't have. This is an amendment you're proposing?
No, this is the...
Or this is the language
this
now.
Is the language.
That's what I thought,
yes.
And I was a little confused when you said you had a proposed amendment. Okay.
Yes.
Got it. All right. That concludes the changes to the bill.
Well, there's one other section. I'll just... We also...
There's one section that's repealed.
Correct. And I should just mention, we believe that that very narrowly defined language in the section that we... That would be repealed by this bill creates more confusion than it solves. However, we've had conversations just this morning with Ms. Catherine White, who I think is also signed up to testify
in opposition.
In opposition, and we'd be happy to. I just wanted to let you know we would be happy to continue a conversation on this particular section with those folks and come back to you at a later date if that was appropriate.
That would be grand. So I'd like to hear from her about what those concerns are. So Ms. White, could you come forward, please? And Mr. Harnish, you can just scoot over or stay where you're at, actually. And we'll hear from Ms. White. If you can state your name for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. And as Mr. Harnish said, this is a very fairly narrow section of the bill, and we are very open to having some discussion on whether our needs get met by the previous changes and portion of the bill. This section applies specifically to kids who are placed in voluntary placement. This is usually when a family is overwhelmed, is seeking temporary assistance or support. The child may be placed in what we're calling support families or a foster family who's taking care of that child for a specific amount of time. The plan is the child returns to the family. And this would just allow that child could remain in the same school while they're in that other temporary placement. And it may be that the other area of the statute meets our needs. We need to take a little better look at that and discuss this with the department. It doesn't happen that often. We are looking for at changes within our developmental disability services system, where as we provide support, we're trying to keep families much more engaged and children returning home and providing those supports. We do know that when a child goes into voluntary placement, that the people who are doing the foster care placements do raise this issue with the families. They are aware of it. Frequently, it's a sort of informal situation that's worked out with a local school, with a foster family actually providing the transportation while the kid is in the other placement. But we welcome the opportunity to work with the department and just make sure that this issue is taken care of.
Okay. I think I'll let you two do that, and then you can come back to us and let us know where you'd like to go. I don't think the committee objects to the bill otherwise, but I could be wrong. I haven't heard any objection this morning or any comments. So why don't you take a look, Senator Cruz? You have a quick question?
Just to point out, the section being repealed is really rather specific, and I think it's appropriate to make sure that we aren't losing some of the protections that are there.
And I agree, Senator. So thank you for your testimony today, and we'll have you come back.
Thank you.
Thank you. close the public hearing on Senate Bill 215. Colleagues, we have another bill to hear on public hearing today, but we're going to skip down to a work session because some folks have to leave. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 384, which is the infamous or famous golden parachute bill. I'm not sure how we want to describe it, but I can tell you, you are going to be pleased with what we've done. So, Ms. Richardson, can you give us a little rundown on that?
Madam Chair, would you like to speak to the Dash 1 amendments, which are gut and stuff amendment, or to the bill?
First, you can speak to the bill and to refresh people, and then to the amendment.
Senate Bill 384 prohibits school districts, education service districts, or public charter schools from entering a contract that grants an administrator specific benefits. It defines administrator and school, allows the school to make contributions to an administrator's retirement plan in lieu of contributions to PERS, but contributions to PERS may not exceed contributions that would have been made to PERS. Applies to contracts on or after the effective date of the measure, declares an emergency, and takes effect upon passage. Would you like me to speak to the Dash 1 and the Dash 2s?
Well, we're not going forward with the Dash 1s.
So we'll speak to the Dash 2s?
So we'll speak to the Dash 2s.
Lovely. The Dash 2s are just like the Dash 1s, except...
That's brilliant.
I can do the Dash 2s. The Dash 2s prohibit school districts, education service districts, public charter schools from entering into contracts with administrators providing compensation for work not performed. It prohibits administrators after termination from purchasing district property or using district property differently than a member of the public. Allows school districts, education service districts, public charter schools to enter into contracts with administrators for health benefits beyond the employment period under certain circumstances. It defines an administrator. It applies to contracts on or after the effective date of the measure. It declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage.
Thank you, Ms. Richardson. And what she was alluding to is the Dash 1s had added community colleges. The Dash 2s takes them back out. We're not getting into that fight. So could I invite the folks up here who've been so diligent at working with me on this, Tricia Smith, Jim Green, Chuck Bennett, come on down. I'm happy to tell the world that we have reached an agreement on this bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
As I was looking at Jim Green in the back there, the thought just occurred to me, he is such a noble traditionalist.
And where does that come from, Senator Weston?
Well, I called him a noble something else later, but he's a big Cubs fan, so we don't want to use the L word. We're just saying he's a traditional baseball fan.
And I would agree. Thank you. Let's move on. So who wants to start out? Tricia, I'm going to ask you to start out because you've been my cohort on this bill. And then we'll ask the two gentlemen seated to your right to talk about how we've made it better for them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith, representing Oregon School Employees Association, a public sector union that represents about 20,000 classified and licensed professionals working in our education system. I'm here to testify in support of the Dash 2 amendments, which are similar to the Dash 1 amendments, and to thank the chair for her continued diligent effort to move forward an issue which we believe creates far more problems with our constituency and the public than it should. And I appreciate very much the work of the chair and the work of my colleagues to my right, as usual, in coming to agreement on this bill, and we support the amendments.
Great. Thank you very much. And so why don't you gentlemen choose who wants to present the amendments, and then the other can speak as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I guess I drew the short straw on bringing forward the Dash 2 amendments. And I would like to thank the chair as well for work on this. We had several conversations and discussions around this and finally got our hands around some amendments that I believe OSBA, and I think Mr. Bennett will speak for COSA, that we can support on this. If you look at the Dash 2 amendments, what we've done is defined administrator very broadly. so that it's not just the superintendents, because I think if you took a look at the original Senate Bill 384, it was really only going after superintendents. We wanted to focus on who are we truly looking at here. And when you take a look at the definition, it includes everybody in a school district that would fall into administrative position, whether it requires a license or not, except for those folks who are covered by ORS 342-805 to ORS 342-937, and you're going to ask me, what's that? That's the Fair Dismissal Appeals Law. And for folks that are licensed educators, in most instances, our classroom teachers and our principals and vice principals are covered by Fair Dismissal Appeals Law. So this truly brings in your associate superintendents, your assistant superintendents, your business managers, your HR directors, your transportation directors. It brings in all those folks that I believe the chair and other folks were taking a look at their contracts and what they wanted to do. If you take a look at page 1, lines 12 through 15 of the dash 2s, it also requires each school district, DSD, or public charter school to enter into a contract with these folks where you're going to talk about conditions for contract termination, extensions, and conditions for employment resignation. One of the concerns we had with this was over the issue of superintendents currently in the law are prohibited from going into a contract for longer than 3 years. And I asked the chair this question was, let's say you have a person who signs into a contract and they're in their first year of their contract and a school board gets elected on the platform of, we want to get rid of that superintendent. And they get elected. And at that point they come in and they say, we want to let you go. Would these amendments prohibit that school district or ESD from paying the rest of that contract off for terminating that individual? And these amendments don't do that. What would occur is it would prohibit a school district or ESD or charter school from saying, we're going to pay you the rest of your contract plus $50,000. It allows you to say, you've got a contract, and in order to remove you, we will pay the rest of your contract out, but it doesn't give what we defined as the golden parachute, that additional $50,000 or that additional $100,000. We still believe a contract's a contract, and the terms of the contract are going to say how we can terminate the person, how the person can resign, but we believe the amendments. We've had our attorneys look at it. I know COSAS had their attorney look at it, and we believe it still allows that to occur, which is the buyout of the rest of the contract, but not the additional sweeteners in there. The other parts of the amendment, I believe your committee administrator has discussed with you, it does allow us to provide health insurance benefits to an individual up until they're Medicare eligible, or if they find work that has health insurance benefits. That's a very important issue, I know, to Mr. Bennett's constituency, and it's one of the things that we use in certain instances to entice people to become an administrator in some of our smaller, more rural school districts, because that's one of their biggest cost issues that they may face out into their career. Finally, I think we get at the issue that was brought up with regard to the Willamette ESD on the purchase of a vehicle. The amendments prohibit an individual from purchasing property or surplus property for a year from which they leave their position. However, it does allow them to use property as any other public member would. And this was brought up by Legislative Counsel. Cindy Hunt brought up the issue to us of, well, property could be coming to a basketball game. Would you prohibit that individual from coming to a basketball game in their community? No. The amendment takes care of that. They can come in just like the rest of the public can. If they wanted to use the gymnasium for some other resource, they have that ability. And walking through the amendments, I believe you get at the issues that the chair has brought up. That will also bring forward some positive news for school districts. I think it's true that when you see things in the newspaper like we've seen over the last several years, it hurts education, especially when we want to go back out to our taxpayers and say we need your support. And we believe the Dash 2 amendments gets our hands around that, and we're supportive of them.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett, representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. My colleagues have gone through the rationale and specifics of the amendments. I want to first express our support for the amendments and appreciation for your assistance over the past couple sessions in getting our hands around this issue, and certainly other members of the committee, Senator Morse and Senator Cruz, who assisted us in kind of getting to this point where we could really talk about the issue. This is really, ultimately, I had our attorney put it, he's a former acting attorney general of the state, went over this, and his reaction was, this is just good public policy. And makes just good sense. I'm sorry that we're not looking at the dash ones, because I think others would find this to be the kind of statute that would save them the trouble that we've been through for the past several sessions. Their choice, not mine. But I do suggest that at a future date, it would be worth it to look at administration across the board, particularly where you have administrators dealing with locally elected bodies, to look at this kind of legislation as a standard for all public officials at this level. And certainly you all have a variety of statutes that control certain kinds of relationships, whether it's ethical or use of public property, the whole gamut. There is certainly no reason this can't extend to local and particularly supervisory employees, where there are contracts that can be both vague and difficult to interpret. So I really think you're on the right track here. This really is a good law, good solid public policy that deserves, I think, a broader discussion. That said, we had the headlines. So
yes, you did.
We're probably the as is often the case. We're looking ahead, and we really appreciate getting this behind us and support the Dash 2s wholeheartedly.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Thank all of you. And I do want to reiterate that the reason we didn't add the community colleges is there haven't been any headlines with community colleges. There hasn't been any consistent violation of the public trust, as we've seen, and I just felt that deserved a greater conversation down the road, and you know, we can bring that back next session if there's a real interest in doing that. This one was important, and contrary to the snarky editorial in the Ben Bulletin on January 30, 2007, I don't think this is taking pot shots at school boards at all. I think this is, I think these buyouts were not rare. We were seeing a number of them. And they cost the taxpayers money. And as Ms. Smith has testified, and even last session we had one of her members come in and testify, the letters to the editor, the comments about, I'm not voting for another school budget because of what I see, I think they were very real. I think it's good public policy, as you indicated, Mr. Bennett. And, you know, I think we've met those concerns that you have. In fact, I know we have. We wouldn't be here today if we weren't doing that. And as I told you when we got in the work group, I had the ability to pass the bill as it stood. But I don't like to work that way. I like to try and resolve the problems that we had and listen to the problems that you saw with this bill. And I think we've done that. We've held you accountable, and the public is going to like that, and their dollar is going to be well spent. Mr. Green.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, you know, I read that editorial from the Ben Bulletin, and I disagree with it. I don't believe, and they hadn't seen the Dash 1s or the Dash 2s, and I'd like to have them take a look at it and take a look at the fact that we're not tying school board members' hands with this bill. We still have the ability to contract with these folks. We have to put the contract in writing. We also have to keep a copy of it in the central office. I think, as Mr. Bennett's already said, and his lawyer said, and my lawyer said, this gets at the heart of good public policy. And I want to thank the chair for getting that work group together, because we know you probably had the votes to get your bill out of committee and off the floor. But there were some problems with that. You recognized that, got us together, and we were able to get our hands around the issue. And I believe that the Ben Bulletin has misled the public with their editorial, and I encourage them to take a look at the Dash 2s, because we're not tying school board members' hands. We wouldn't support a bill that did that, and that's not what the Dash 2s are about.
Thank you, Mr. Green. It's just a darn good thing we don't legislate based on editorials and newspapers.
Madam Chair, I'd like to comment on the editorial. I'm sorry. See what I said? Noble traditionalist.
Yes, he is. Yes, Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, I think the Ben Bulletin editorial indicates the problem that often happens when people look at this process at a snapshot moment is they really miss the the richness of discussion that can occur and the outcomes that can be successful for all. And I think that's where we arrived this time. And so we're really pleased we were able to do it. This is troubling stuff for all of us whenever these kinds of issues come up. So I think that this has been handled very appropriately. And again, represents the kind of policy I think we'll be looking at as a legislature in the future for other public employees in similar circumstance to school administrators.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for working this bill. Interestingly enough, in the first session when we were hearing this, I had a call come into my office that said, that's the most unintelligent thing Senator Morris has ever said in comments about this bill. And I agree with you, Mr. Bennett. This is a snapshot in time. People listen. They need to look at the final product. And this is a good product, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, and I appreciate your help on the work group as well. Right. Senator Westland and Senator Cruz.
I also want to thank not only the chair but the process and members at the dais, because I think, as you well know, I had problems with the bill as it was introduced last session, spoke against it on the floor. I would have had problems with it this session, and it's just a good example of what is really one of the best things Oregonians have going for them, and that's a good, active, forthright committee process, and that's what we've seen here today, and I very much appreciate your and the chair's endeavors to make this what we have today. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 Amendment to Senate Bill 384.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 Amendment to Senate Bill 384. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 384 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 384 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Senator Cruz.
Thank you. I echo my colleagues and folks on the panel. You did a good job here. I could couch it differently, but you did a good job, and you were responsive, and you were courteous, as you always are, and I really appreciate your leadership on these issues.
Thank you for those comments. I'm very pleased. Today we saw earlier in the bill just before this, Senate Bill 434, the testimony from the community about how we might make that bill better, and that's what the committee process is about. Senator Westland hit it on the head, and I appreciate it. I appreciate this committee. So I'd like to hear an oral vote because Ms. Gravel's been quiet all morning.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Westland?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. And Senator Metzger is excused. Senate Bill 384, having passed, is out of this committee, and I'm going to carry that one. Yeah. So we will close the work session on that bill. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 216, and I think we're going to be able to finish our agenda today. So, Ms. Richardson, what's up with 216?
Senate Bill 216 mandates that every child at a youth care center, whether public or private, receive appropriate education. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007.
Great. And I have only one person to testify, the department. Imagine that. Nancy Lantini from the Department of Education will talk to us about why they want this bill.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Lantini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships at the department. I'm here today to provide some information on Senate Bill 216. It's really a clarification that we're seeking in this bill. The statute as it stands right now isn't clear, and this bill will seek to put into statute what is currently a practice already at the department and with school districts. Let me explain what this means. We have some, under the same roof essentially, students who are placed in detention centers by the court for detention purposes, and also students who are placed by juvenile detention, juvenile agencies or other agencies for treatment purposes in what they call youth care centers, but they're both in the same facility. We have five right now such joint facilities in Oregon. Both sets of kids receive public education. The responsibility for kids that are placed in detention centers for detention purposes are clearly on the shoulders of the Department of Education. The statute for youth care centers right now states that youth that are placed in privately operated youth care centers are the responsibility of the school district in which the location of that facility. But it doesn't specify anywhere what happens with the responsibility of youth for education in publicly operated youth care centers. As we look at what we had, these children in the youth care centers do not fall under the definition of detention facilities or detention youth, of course, and so they really don't fall under the Department of Education and for us to claim those students. What we're asking for then is a clarification in the bill that would indicate no matter if it's a public agency or a private agency that is operating one of these youth care centers, that the school district then would retain the responsibility for the students that are in the facility. It's happening already at this point. The districts are serving those kids. This would just clarify that no matter which center a student is in, they would receive an education. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
I think Senator Cruz has one.
Actually, I'm very clear on this. I don't. This just makes sense. It's a clarification.
Yeah. Senator Morse.
And I would be led to believe, Madam Chair, that there's no fiscal because we're already doing it. This just cleans up the language. That's what we're doing.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, yes, there would be no fiscal impact. The districts already are claiming those students under the ADM as it is in the district.
Okay. Great. You were the only one person signed up to testify, so thank you very much for coming. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 216. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 216.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 216 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 216 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion, colleagues? Okay. Any objection? Ms. Gravel, go ahead. Do your thing.
Senator
Morris?
Aye.
Senator Wesley?
Aye.
Vice Chancellor?
Aye.
Aye. And Senator Metzger's excused. Senate Bill 216, having received the constitutional majority, is passed. And you know what? Senator Wesley, you haven't carried a bill yet.
It's about time.
My shoulders are narrow. My arms are weak.
It's yours, sweetie. It's yours.
You're the only one that could take a bill that long and stretch it out to 5 minutes.
That's right. There you go.
I will do that on the floor just because this is passion. I am committed. And you will rue the day you said those words.
Okay. We're going to go into work session on our remaining two bills. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 70. Ms. Richardson, what's going on with that one?
Senate Bill 70 directs the Secretary of State to enter into agreements with semi-independent state agencies and the Oregon Tourism Commission to set financial review schedules. Deletes requirement that the Secretary set audit schedules for those entities. Allows the Secretary to contract for financial reviews of semi-independent state agencies or the Oregon Tourism Commission with an independent CPA. Deletes the requirement that the Secretary audit or review a state agency when an agency director retires. Deletes the requirement that the Secretary post audit disbursements from the Department of Veterans Affairs Conservatorship Revolving Account. It repeals the requirement that Secretary audit account of sheriff who performs services for the state. Declares emergency and takes effect upon passage. Would you like me to speak to the -1 amendments?
Yes, please.
The -1 amendments retain the requirement to audit or review a state agency when an agency director retires. It provides an exception to this requirement if an audit or review occurred within 6 months prior to the director's retirement, or if the secretary has not received a report of malfeasance by the retiring director within the prior 12 months.
And Senator Metzger was involved in that work group, wasn't he?
Yes, I worked with Senator Metzger and Senator Cruz.
Oh, okay, both of them. All right. So anyone, we're in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 70.
Great. Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 70. Any discussion about that?
Madam Chair, it makes me very okay. I think this is a good amendment. It gives discretion without losing oversight.
Okay. And I know, Senator Wesson, you had some questions. Are you all right with this now?
I'm fine.
Okay. And Senator Morris, I think this was the bill that both of you voted no on last session and you didn't know why.
Now we know why. It's a better bill.
That's exactly right. So are you fine with it now?
I am fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. Great. So, hearing no objection, the dash one is approved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 70 as amended to the floor, or the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 70 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? If not, Ms. Gravel, there you go. You're on.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Wexler?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye, and Senator Metzger once again is excused. Senate Bill 70 has passed. And, yes?
I don't want to sound like a broken record up here, but I think it needs to be said because it doesn't get said enough. This is just another example of you effectively working with a diverse group of stakeholders to bring consensus through the committee process in Oregon. And I just want to acknowledge that.
Well, thank you. I think that this committee has really done well at trying to resolve these differences in these bills. I've had lots of participation from every member, and I really appreciate that, because that's the only way we're going to get this done. We are on warp speed, so thank you. And I'm going to assign this one to Senator Morse so he can redeem his vote.
I'll try to figure out why it makes sense this time.
I'm sure Elon Hassan will be able to help you with your comments on the floor. All right, we are down to the last one, which really was a lot of work as well. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 47.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 47 directs the Department of Education to establish a system to review business practices of school districts and efficiency review teams, establishes an efficiency review advisory panel to advise the department on the system, review results, and responses to review results, allows expenditures up to $1 million from the state school fund for use during the 2007-2009 biennium to administer required activities, declares an emergency and takes effect July 1st, 2007. There are dash one and dash two amendments. Would you like me to speak to either or both?
Yes, we heard this bill on Tuesday and the discussion about why we needed a dash two, so why don't you refresh our memories?
The dash two incorporates much of the dash one amendments, but it requires the report of the audit described in the dash one amendments to be provided to the State Board of Education and the district audited. The report does not have to be provided to the governor. In addition, it adds a nominee by the Oregon School Employees Association to the District Best Business Practices Advisory Committee. And I should mention this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And that it does. So, Senator Cruz, why don't you start the ball rolling?
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 47.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 47. Discussion, colleagues? I think we heard it all on Tuesday, and I'm very proud of what everybody did, the work on that. That's just fabulous. So, hearing no objection, the dash 2 is approved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 47 as amended. Now, I've heard two different ways to do this, so I'm going to do it the way I've always done it, because Judy said it worked.
It does.
I'm going to move Senate Bill 47 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
And that works, and the other way works, so I'll do it your way because you're my vice chair. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 47 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the floor of the Senate with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion about that motion?
Another good piece of work, Madam Chair.
Great. All right. I think we've done well by school districts and the public here. This has been Accountability Week for the last 2 weeks, and I'm very pleased. So, Ms. Gravel?
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Wexler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye, and Senator Metzger's excused.
Nick Metzger with some of these.
I know.
Wally-gagging around.
I know. We should have given them all. Senate Bill 47 is off to Ways and Means, where we will see it again, Senator Morris and I. And I'll close the work session. And I think that does it, folks. We've been knocking out the work.
Good week.
Yeah.
For the most part.
next week, we're delving into kindergarten and Head Start pre-K issues, so be prepared for that. And thank you all very much for your attendance. We're adjourned.